Joseph.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
And this show is also sponsored by GoToMeeting. Have you ever had that opportunity where you're kind of sitting there wondering, how am I going to get in touch with somebody? How am I going to spend a little time, one-on-one in a meeting? I'm not there. I'm somewhere else. I'd love to show them these files. Have you ever checked out GoToMeeting.com? Because GoToMeeting.com, what you can do is, with your client or with your friend or whoever you're talking to, you can actually share desktops and you can move things back and forth, files, and you can actually have a meeting where you make a presentation. And at the same time, you can be viewing what's happening right from the comfort of your own desk. You don't have to travel. Those expensive airplane tickets are no longer an option. Use GoToMeeting, and you can simply save a lot of money, save a lot of time, and really have that high impact that you want to have. I use it all the time. I think it's a great, great tool. Check out GoToMeeting at GoToMeeting.com/podcast. That's GoToMeeting.com/podcast for your 30-day free trial. I recommend it highly. And hello, and how are you? This is Andrew Horowitz, and welcome aboard to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And if you haven't heard this before, and maybe this is your first or maybe even your second time, well, you're in luck because we have not one but two amazing guests today. We're going to start off with Harry Dent, who wrote a new book that is sure to depress you, not because it's a bad book, because it's all about the Great Depression ahead, as the title indicates. And I have read, as a matter of fact, I was one of the early readers of this book. He gave it to me as a, before it was actually published, and I was able to write a couple of pieces for him and recommend it highly because Harry Dent, if you haven't tracked his work before, it is superb. I call him a demographic economist, where he's really tracking the growth of the human population and the effect on an aging population on economies. So we'll get to him, and then we're going to have your favorite Mish, Mike Shedlock, is going to be here talking about the economy, where to go. And I think I mentioned beforehand that he had a dramatic kind of a view of what is going to be occurring in the markets moving forward. He's going to have this I think he had a viewpoint of about 600 or so on the S&P 500. That's the last time that he was with us. He talked about that. Let's see if he changed his tune. And before we get to that, I just want to kind of, I want to mention to you that I get a lot of emails, people saying, hey, what's going on with like these likes of Susie Orman and all these other celebs that are talking about money? Do we believe them? Do we not? You know my feeling about buy and hold, that it's good during the good times. But other than that, you got to really be careful because, if you look at the Fidelity Contra Fund down 50% last year, you look at Ken Huebner's funds down 50%, and the idea that buying and holding is the only way to play this game is just hogwash. I mean, I'm not going with that. You're not going with that. You're a disciplined investor. You're listening here. I know you are. So the fact is that we need to do something a little bit more creative. But listen to this. This is the kind of stuff that's coming over the airway from Susie Orman lately. I mean, they're giving away books. And listen to what she has to say about her goals. And I want you to kind of think about this for a second. A discussion with Oprah Winfrey, and she's discussing the downloads with Susie Orman. Listen to this.
People in these tough economic times, that last week, this is what she did. She offered her new mega bestseller, Susie Orman's 2009 Action Plan, for free. Yes, the free word, on Oprah.com. And over 1.4 million of you downloaded that book.
I love that.
Don't you? Thank you.
I love that. I was disappointed that 2 million people didn't download it. That was my goal, honest to God. And why didn't you all download it more? You should have all called your friends. You still can. You have a few hours to do so.
A few hours, because for 2.5 hours, actually, yeah, it's still going to be for free.
And it was like, I really thought that 2 million people would at least do it.
Well, I think 1.4 is an enormous amount of people.
Yes, but my personal goal was 2 million people.
2 million. Well, so, you're going to end up selling that many. This is what's so interesting. How does your publisher agree to do that? How does your publisher say, yes, let's give away 1.4 4 million or 1 million or 800,000 or what? How did you get the publisher to agree to do that?
Because that's a publisher that understands that at a time like right now, even the book, I have to say,
yes,
even the book is $5. You know, you go on Amazon.com, the book is $5 wow. now and 69 cents. They've discounted it. Everybody's selling it for that is selling it. Because how can you, at a time like this, make money off of people that are suffering? Mm-hmm. So when you're a finance person, you're writing a book, you can't come up with a hardback book that's $24 and they don't have $24 today. People don't have any money to do anything. So give it away for free. And then eventually, you know, the publisher has to make some money somewhere.
All right, so let me pipe in here for a second here. Why don't people have money? People have money don't have money because they're listening to this Susie Orman who told them to keep their money in a 401k, in a mutual fund, in a portfolio, and don't change. People have money. The disciplined investors that are listening have money. You know, and the point here is why aren't people downloading your book, Susie? I am sorry, Susie Orman, but you know what? The fact is they're not downloading it the level you want to, which I can't believe you basically spit in Oprah's face right there, saying that, you know, you were disappointed after she was so proud of what she did at OprahWinfrey.com or Oprah.com, whatever it is. And then you say you're disappointed with how many people download it. But the reason they didn't download it, hello, it's garbage. You can't keep on telling people the same thing over and over again. Now, if I'm aggravating somebody out there, you can tell me, I'll listen, but there's something fundamentally wrong with this whole setup here where you have a book and someone who's sitting there and talking about finance when they really don't have the understanding of what finance is, more than just putting your money into somebody's hand, like a mutual fund manager or some other type of just, you know, the Dow Jones or an index or something that is nothing more than a quote-unquote lazy portfolio. And boy, did I have fun with lazy portfolios this week. You go check out the blog. I wrote a couple things and we got into a couple of debates with a few people that are acquaintances and people that I've dealt with before, and they were unhappy about how I was chastising them for this whole concept of a lazy portfolio, not chastising them because of it, but because they were proud of the fact that a lazy portfolio that beat the S&P 500 by maybe 10% last year, they were standing up and cheering about. And there's a website, I think it's called Boggleheads, and they're just constantly trying to reassure them. It's like positive affirmations, right? I remember going to a class one time when the instructor said, what you got to do is this. I want you to record on a daily basis positive affirmations saying, I'm a good person, I am successful, I am reaching my goals, I have many friends. And you recorded this and you played it back to yourself, right? In those days it was cassette tapes, but you played it back to yourself. Why? So you start believing your own muck, kind of like the Dale Carnegie thing of, you know, smile on the outside and you'll be happy on the inside. It's garbage. You want to try to fool yourself, Miss Orman, and Boggleheads, and all these people that are talking about lazy portfolios, the fact that you beat the S&P 500 utilizing some ridiculous statistical inference that's not even correct when you look at just maybe one statistical set of numbers rather than looking at it on a risk-adjusted and on a what we'll call a positive biased return base. It's just silly. It's just a waste of time. And trying to convince yourself of all this is nothing more than having positive affirmations. You know, if we made a tape today, what we'd say? Something like this, if we were a lazy portfolio believer. We'd say something like this. You know, even though my portfolio busted out last year, I beat the S&P 500 by 2%. And you'd say something like, I'm really glad that I have a portfolio that I don't have to work on because it saves me a lot of time. My portfolio is made up of great mutual funds of the past. I don't have to worry about the future. I don't have to look at things. You could say things like, over 20 years, there's never been a down 20-year period until recently. You know, and you could go on this whole charade of trying to convince yourself. That's what troubles me the most, the trying to convince yourself that everything will be fine. I will tell you that there was a time recently, the November through December time period, that scared me, and I'll tell you why. In November, when we saw that bounce from the November 20th capitulation point, and the market started coming back pretty strongly on no fundamentals and no benefit on the economic front, I said to myself, this is going to be a trap. Because what happens here is when we don't have the basis for the underlying movement, what will happen is people will buy into it, and unfortunately, they'll get very complacent. Complacency, or the word lazy, interchangeable, is the downfall of a portfolio. We're not playing games here. This is money. This is my money. This is your money. You know, the fact is that, you know, I put my money where I speak. You know, I have my money in the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy. My money is right alongside of my investor's money. My money is right alongside the strategy that we use. This is not a game like a mutual fund manager will have their money somewhere else and, you know, they potentially could be investing in something they're talking about. We are eating our own pudding, so to speak. But at the same time, you know, you have to wonder when Susie Orman says that it doesn't matter if she loses all her money because she only has $1 million in the market and the rest of her money is in municipal bonds and she doesn't really care. How in touch is that kind of person with the reality of what's going on today if they don't care? Therefore, they're giving advice based on the idea of they don't care. Just frustrates me to no end. And I'm sorry for just going on and on about this, but it's time to kind of wake people up. And I told you this before. You know, if your financial advisor is telling you time and time again just to simply, you know, buy and hold, I told you before, I'll tell you again. What did I tell you to do? I told you to fire them. If they didn't put hedges on your portfolio, you need to fire them. If they didn't give you any advice other than put more money in at the low point and said that, oh, we know how to market time, just pop money in and then they're never going to take it out again, people, fire them. And if, in fact, your financial advisor was too cowardly to talk you through what was going on and doesn't have the opportunity or the decency to have true transparency in what they're doing by giving you reports and insight, you need to fire them. They're not going to take themselves off by saying, we didn't do a good job for you. That's not going to happen. You need to look somewhere else, whether or not you want to just do it on your own and you want to get the education, whether you not want to hire somebody that has active management, has true transparency, whatever it is, there's something. This is a new year. You know, change is coming. We have a new president that's about to be inaugurated in a matter of days, or depending on when you're listening to this, it could have happened already. It is time to make a change. Don't be scared. Don't be scared. The fear that you're feeling is just a fear of the unknown, but fear of loss is a much greater situation, and the reality of a loss is a much more difficult process for us to deal with right now. I don't want you losing any more money. I'm not sure if the market right now is headed for another dive like we just saw, and of course, there's option expiration in parentheses here. Go check out the website. We have a whole piece on options expiration and how it affects the market. Go to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and make sure to do an RSS feed, you know, to put that in your reader, because you're going to get some great things. We're writing a lot more on MSN. We're writing a lot more on our site. And the Strategy Lab, of course, we're 14% since August on our portfolios. Check out how we did it, because every single transaction is transparent. It's available for you. And I think it's something that you deserve to have, because you're good people, you know, and it doesn't mean that we just have to follow along like sheep with bad investment advice. Susie, you get $2 million downloads. Great. Good going. But what about the advice that you're giving? Do you all look back, and are you all ever looking back and saying, you know, I told people to sit tight and not do a thing back in the summertime, and there was subsequently a 40% loss? I mean, do we have an apology? No. We just keep on rambling along and hiding from the facts that we're just giving advice that is not at all anything more than just a simple regurgitation of what we had for the last 10 years. Times are a-changing. Times are a-changing. Well, let's get to my first guest. It's Harry Dent. He's a great fellow. He's going to be actually at the Money Show coming up in February. If you haven't had the opportunity, we'll put a link on the website as well to meet Harry and to meet me. I'm going to be there. We're going to have a cocktail party, give away some free books. If you haven't told us that you want to attend, it's in Orlando in February. Go to the website. There's a little link there. Put your name in. If there's enough people that want to come, we'll have a little gathering get together. Last time it was really great. Okay, so we're here with Harry Dent, the author of The Great Depression Ahead, a new book. It is, it's a depressing title. It's How to Prosper in the Crash Following the Greatest Boom in History. Harry, how are you?
Good, Andrew.
So, I've had this kind of, you and I have talked a lot. I've had this nagging commentary, and I've said, okay, Harry, you know, we have all these things going on that are negative. We have, countries going bankrupt, reneging on their bonds. We have you know, currencies being devalued. We have oil at 140 to 30. We have, I just, the list goes on and on. And I said to you, you know, why is it that we have to have a huge upswing prior to the next crash? Now, I want you to hear something. I had an epiphany. I said, oh my God, Harry's right. I'll tell you why. I said, because if the government just throws absolutely the kitchen sink into our economy, when I say our government, every government that is, right? It invariably can be such an incredible boost over the long term, or the when I say long term, I'm talking about a short term, long term, that is, you know, over a period, that we could have this gigantic move. Then all of a sudden we create this giant vat of nothingness underneath where everything just blows out and crashes. What do you think about that?
Well, again, you know, what we've been seeing from the beginning here is, you know, in most major financial crises, number one, take about 5 years to work out, 3 years minimum, not 1 year or two like typical recessions. And this is a thing where we've seen the first wave down in stocks, which will follow with a weakening economy into at least the summer of 2009. And we'll get some type of rebound with, I mean, this is massive stimulus the government's throwing at this. I mean, they're throwing out the kitchen sink here. Into late 2009, early 2010, but then ultimately the demographic trends are so strong down, not just baby boomers peaking in their spending as a generation, but an acceleration of their retirement starting next year in 2010, that they will not be able to stop this tide, and we'll go back down, we think, in 2010, stronger and deeper. So yes, you get your first crash, you get a hope, and you get some rebound and stimulus, but then it doesn't work and you get your next crash. And this happened in Japan. It happened in past downturns. And so the biggest thing to understand here is this is not just another recession from businesses overbuilding and consumers overspending. It's a major peak that only occurs every 40 years in generational spending. And it's a major downturn. And the U.S. government is in debt to the rest of the world, unlike Japan when they faced their downturn in the 90s. And so we have limited options for just blowing our way out of this.
Mm-hmm. So I'm looking at your book. Again, this is a new book. And I saw, man, you were way up on the bestseller list. You're like number, I don't know, way up there. You know, how high did you hit? Did you hit a...
Well, we're 23 today on Amazon. Ooh. That's all I can see.
Wow, that's huge. That's tremendous. Well, you know, it's interesting that... You know, you have a lot of things that you talked about in your other books, the various S-curves and the various discussions here. I think it's very interesting where you talk about the migration from the various states, you know, going from, let's say, from the Northeast to the South. Now, how does that play out when we're seeing such a dramatic problem in the Northeast because of the financial crisis and the people that worked in the Northeast were very much part of the financial industry? So how does that accelerate some of the discussion of problems in the Northeast, and then, you know, with the fact that people were migrating anyway?
Well, you know, it tends to make it worse because the people who migrate are people in their 20s and early 30s, not retirees as most people think, retiring. So what happens is you get this downturn in real estate's much more overvalued in New York and New Jersey and California than it is in Alabama and South Carolina and North Carolina and New Mexico and Utah and other places. And this downturn only makes it more urgent for this new generation. The new generation is not causing the downturn. They're going to cause the next upturn, but they're going to start moving into this moving stage. And they're going to say, oh my gosh, with this downturn, it's even more important to move to a more affordable area that's growing due to migration. So yes, we're moving from the Northeast and upper Midwest and California into the Southeast and into the Midwest. I'm sorry, into the Southwest. And that is going to actually accelerate in the next several years. So that's one of the areas where businesses and developers can target, even in this very severe downturn.
Mm-hmm. So, I know you do a lot of long-term projections, and you have actually a short-term newsletter and an alert system that you have that you can have people, they can subscribe to. But one of the things that I found interesting lately is there's a lot of discussion by people that I know about the wrong type of stimulus. I don't know how much you track this, but it's a Keynesian approach to throw in everything that you can, something that we really didn't want to do, but almost that we have no choice to do at this point. And the world is seemingly buying this as well and going along with that. I mean, is this the right approach, or is this just going to make the situation that much worse in the future?
Well, you know, for China, it's probably the right approach. They're like us in the early 1900s, an emerging country that's becoming a developed country rapidly, a net exporter. They can afford to take some of their booty from exporting to the world and stimulate their economy. We are the greatest net debtor in the world. We didn't used to be, but we have become in recent decades. And we can't afford, since we rely on so many countries around the world to buy our debt and trade for our trade deficit, we can't afford just to stimulate our way out of this and devalue the dollar, because these people, China's holding $1.9 trillion and Japan a whole ton of dollars in the Middle East. At some point, we're going to scare these people and they're going to say, my gosh, we can't support you anymore because our holdings are going down. So we are in a difficult position here, and that's why we think the government stimulus plan ultimately may help us get a little bit of a bounce in late 2009, early 2010. By 2010, they're going to be limited in how much they can stimulate by the rest of the world and the falling dollar, and we're going to go right back down into this demographic slide, just like Japan did throughout the whole 90s.
So just to go back to the currency for 1 second, then we'll move into some of your other predictions and things you're talking about here. You're probably familiar with Peter Schiff. I had him on a podcast a few months ago, and he's pretty radical. I mean, you know, it's one thing to have these long-term predictions as you do, and I think, you know, we'd probably say that you're pretty radical on some of these things. Right, but radical, and from mainstream, if you will. And he's talking about pretty much a dollar that's going down to, zero. I mean, really just being, you know, really harsh on the dollar. And I'm of the frame of mind that, you know, absent the comparative tool of using the dollar against something, which is the only way you can really judge what the value of the dollar is, that the dollar can't really go to zero because there's too many other countries that are doing the same thing that we are, essentially devaluing their currencies. You know, what do you say about that?
Yeah, exactly. That's a very good point, Andrew, because what we see is a lead lag effect. The United States has led us into this downturn. We had the banking crisis start here and spread around the world, and in the CMO, CDO, and subprime crisis. Our economy went down first, but you're right. Then Europe went down, and China and India and other places, and then they have to stimulate, and they have to lower interest rates to follow us. So we see kind of a perverse relationship with the dollar. The U.S. dollar's gone almost opposite to the economy and the U.S. stock market, so that it's probably, you know, it's going up recently while the stocks are going down, and it'll probably go down when we finally get a rebound in commodity prices and stocks and stuff. And ultimately, that dollar going down will restrain the U.S. government from just going nuts on stimulus. So I agree with you. It's not going to go to zero. The world can't afford it to. We can't afford it to. But it's going to look like it's going to crash. I would not be surprised to see the dollar, you know, go back up to as high as, you know, 120 on the euro, and then go as low as $2, which is really bad, 50 cents to the euro. And I think when we get to that point, the U.S. government will say, we can't keep interest rates low, we can't keep supporting treasury bonds and government debt, and we can't keep stimulating our economy, or it is going to go to zero. And so I don't think it'll get to zero, because we'll read the handwriting on the wall.
So what's the biggest, you know, as you finish this book, and again, it's called The Great Depression Ahead, I would very much encourage anyone to pick up a copy. And actually, Harry's going to be with me, well, not with me, but we'll be there together at the Orlando The Money Show in February, the first week or so in February. So if you want to get your copy, I'm sure you'll have a few there, Harry. But what was, when you were writing this book and finishing this book and going through this, what was the biggest surprise that you may have come to in terms of our economy and the global economies as compared to maybe some of the things that you were seeing before?
Well, the biggest surprise, I mean, I had to finish writing this book, I think, at the end of May in 2008, before a lot of this downturn and banking crisis unveiled. And the biggest surprise, and something I could only adjust minor in the last little stages in September or something, was that oil crashed so much and commodities crashed so much. I mean, that was a bubble, and we were saying, hey, that's the last major bubble. But we expected oil to come down to like $50 a barrel at worst, and then to rally back up near the highs or even the new highs. And what that said to us is, you know, this deflationary process has already begun. I mean, even the oil and commodity bubbles, which by our cycles would be due to peak around late 2009 or so, have already peaked. So you know, continues to make us think, gosh, yeah, this deflationary slide has begun. Credit is contracting. Yes, the government stimulus, I mean, it's massive, will have some impact in the next year. But you know what? It's not going to be enough to get our economy going. We changed our position to saying, you know, it won't be as much inflation in $150 or $180 oil prices that will kill the rebound. It'll be the fact that the rebound simply isn't that strong, and then the markets and the world markets lose confidence in the rebound and lose confidence in the U.S. dollar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's the amazing thing about oil and the continuation of it going down recently is a testament to two things, I think. Number one is a testament to the consumption and the capabilities of what's going on around the world. But the second thing is the outright unfortunate time that we live in, that, you know, when you see a Goldman Sachs analyst calling for $200 oil and for all of the various components, trying to force OPEC to increase output during the summer, when there really was not a supply-demand issue, and nobody talking about it on the back end. 60 Minutes did a piece on it only a few weeks ago. It was the lamest thing I've ever seen. You know, we uncovered this back in the summer, and, this whole Enron loophole issue. But I got to tell you something. You know, we live in a time that I find very difficult for the average investor to really go it and try to invest, because they're not on a level playing. None of us are on a level playing field anymore. The fact is that they've kind of killed every golden goose that's there. Don't you think so?
No, exactly. There's been so much speculation and so much higher-end stuff that it really is hard for the everyday investor to read these markets and stuff. We did a thing in our newsletter, I don't know, say about a year ago. Michael Masters, you know, did a testimony in front of the Congress, and he said, you know what? This oil run-up is at least 50% driven by speculation, mm-hmm. not just mm-hmm. supply-demand. And the fact that oil's fallen from 147 to 32?
Unbelievable.
When all China did was go from 10% growth to 6, and we slowed down minor at this point, even though it's going to be more, it shows it was probably more like 60, 70% speculation. And so it shows, like, bubbles are bubbles, and you've had too much money running around, too low interest rates, too much leverage. And that's why our economy has to deleverage. The government is coming up with a plan that says, you know what the answer to a lot of leverage and too much debt is? More leverage.
More
and
leverage.
More debt.
I know,
that
that's what I was going to say.
Right. It just can't be right.
Yeah, there's something wrong.
A 10-year-old could understand that.
Well, what's really fascinating, and then we're going to go, because I know you have to get going. I'm glad that we had the opportunity to get together today. But it's fascinating to me. It really is fascinating that we're talking about this credit crisis, and it really is amazing that the entire discussion keeps on getting back to the fact that banks aren't lending. And we understand that they are the grease. The credit is the grease for an economy in general. But when it comes to the average person, we don't want any more credit. That's what ruined this whole situation to begin with, because they were riding on something that wasn't theirs to begin with. Really kind of nutty.
Yeah, and that's what we see happening. The government's putting all the stimulus, they're putting money in the banking system, they're keeping interest rates low by buying government debt and bonds, and they're going to give another big round of stimulus to consumers. The truth is, what we see is, even with these very low interest rates now, mortgage rates are now under 5% in mm-hmm. some cases, 30-year mm-hmm. fixed. What we look at the stats, hey, people are refinancing their mortgages, surprise, surprise, but they're not buying new homes.
Right.
And the same thing happened in Japan. Very low interest rates did not stimulate a major rebound. In fact, almost no rebound in home buying, and home prices kept sliding there in the 90s because a generation had bought their largest homes and their kids leave the nest, and people don't buy bigger homes after that. They downsize. They don't need it, and they start to save instead of spend because they're heading towards retirement. So the government doesn't understand the demographics of this crisis, and therefore, to me, they're going to stimulate too much, and it's going to look reckless in retrospect, because there's so much in debt, and they would have thought, well, the economy will come back. It won't come back. There mm-hmm. aren't people to spend money.
Right. So in closing, Harry, I have a question. What happened that over the last 1 year, we are so desensitized to the word billions? You know, I think I recall a year ago or so... No, seriously.
It's got to be trillions now to make an impact.
But it's serious. I'm really serious about this. I mean, it's pretty spooky that we're talking these kind of numbers that, you know, oh, $40 billion. $40 billion? What do you mean $40 billion? It used to be, if you heard the word $4 billion lost, you'd run for the hills. You know, I don't understand how this is all. I mean, where did this all come from?
You know, it just comes from bubbles. And we're not somebody that says, like economists, that bubbles are bad and we're all bad people for going for them. Bubbles create incredible innovation and leverage innovation at a certain time in our economic cycle. Mm-hmm. But then they got to go away and they got to deflate. And that brings us down to the best businesses that are really going to survive. And that means a lot of businesses and banks have to go under. So it comes from a bubble psychology. I mean, this whole crisis in investments, hedge funds offering huge returns with huge leverage, came from trying to sustain the returns of the 90s. Mm-hmm. Same thing, the CDO, CMO, subprime crisis. They had to package all these treasury, these mortgages, and get people 5, 6, 7% fixed income returns when really 3, 4% was more normal.
Right.
So people got addicted to the high returns of the 90s, and they don't want to give them up. And things have grown, debt's grown so much. That people do, yeah, you have to think in trillions now instead of billions. And that tells you, you know what, something's wrong.
Something's
wrong.
We have
to deflate back down to reality. And we need home prices to get down to $100,000, $150,000 for the average house so the next generation can afford to have the American dream. This is going to be good for the economy long term. To see deflation, it's just going to be painful at first.
Sometimes, no pain, no gain, but sometimes we don't want to have the pain. Well, Harry Dent, the author of The Great Depression Ahead, How to Prosper in the Crash Following the Greatest Boom in History. I thank you. I'll see you in a couple of weeks, and I'll make sure I'm telling you right now, gang, pick up this book. This is great stuff. You'll really enjoy it. Harry, thanks a lot.
Yeah, in fact, there's a great deal on Amazon right now.
Yeah, I saw that. I'll put a link on the site. We'll make sure people get over
there
and pick it up.
It's cheaper than we are at our website.
Oh, really? Is that right? That's how it goes. Undercutting. So, all right, we'll make sure they get that, and thanks so much. See you in a couple of weeks. I look forward to having dinner.
Okay, thanks.
All right, bye-bye. Oh, Harry Dent. Refreshing and very nice to, I think it's great to hear such clear and very accurate long-term views on things. That's what I love about Harry Dent. And we're going to get to the shorter-term views on really what's happening now and the outlook in just a second. Just a reminder that if you haven't, we have a brand new Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy website, the blog, for clients only. One of the things that people love so much about the strategy is that we have a complete transparency of how we are managing money. You know, when we're buying and selling, when we make a mistake because maybe something didn't go the direction that we thought it would, when we are moving into a particular sector, analysis of the technicals, the fundamentals, all that is inside of this private blog. A lot of people asked us to take a look. So we set up a trial. So if you do want a trial, we're only going to take a certain amount of people at a time. But if you want a 1-week trial just to see what we're talking about, because you're kind of interested in maybe investing with us but really not sure about, you know, what it's all about, send an email to trial@thedisciplinedinvestor.com and we'll set you up immediately with a 1-week trial, okay? So just want to get that out of the way. Let's talk about some of the things that are happening right now and some projections on the S&P. And here we are today again with a crowd favorite, a good friend of mine, Mish Mike Shedlock, who is, I don't know, qualify him as an economist, a very avid and prolific blogger, and someone who I find that takes apart and questions the system quite regularly in a way for us to not only understand it, but to get a different perspective. So, Mish, how are you today, buddy?
I'm fine. It's always a pleasure to be on the show.
So, lots happened since the last...
Oh, my God. What's happened since the last... You're laughing because there's a thousand things that have happened in the last 3 weeks since we've talked. But the news out today is that the CPI has risen 0.1% annually. It's the smallest increase since 1954. The amazing thing about this is all of the pundits coming out that had predicted massive inflation are now seeing deflation, but they still don't even know what it is. We've been talking about this actually for the last couple of years here, that inflation and deflation are monetary things, and that one has to not just look at the amount of money that the Fed is printing, but one also has to look at the credit that's actually being destroyed on the balance sheets of banks. And it's the latter. That's why the stock market has fallen off the cliff. That's why there aren't any jobs. It's because we have a credit contraction, especially mark-to-market, in the asset sheets of banks. Well, they don't want to lend.
Yep.
and we have consumers that have had an attitude change, and we need to talk a little bit more about that as well.
Yeah, I think. But let me talk about let's explore for a moment, just quickly, mark to market, because there's been a lot of discussion lately about the idea of just totally. We talked about this before too, but totally getting rid of the mark to market idea, and you know, it's kind of interesting because I stepping back for a minute, I could see both sides of the discussion. I'm not saying I agree with both sides, but I could see both sides of the discussion and talking about how mark to market can effectively, you know, bring down a company, a bank, whatever, that, you know, when there's illiquidity and there's a general aversion to whatever the particular product is that we're dealing with. But on the other hand, it is a way in which, and a reasonable way in which, that you have to value something. So until they come up with something that is better, which only would be something more financially, I guess it would be something that would have to be, I suppose, calculated in a way that would honestly benefit the, you know, the banks or whatever. I mean, what else can we have besides a mark to market?
Well, your first statement was actually wrong, but that's what we hear out there. Mark-to-market doesn't bring down Bear Stearns. Mark-to-market didn't bring down Lehman. Mark-to-market's not bringing down Citigroup. It's leverage that brought down Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, and is threatening to bring down Citigroup.
And
if these corporations weren't leveraged 30 or 40 to 1, they never would be in a problem.
Right. No, I agree.
They would hold these assets to term. You know, there might be a little bit of write-offs, but when you're leveraged 30 or 40 to 1, actually, I think Bear Stearns and Lehman were leveraged 50 to 1, it doesn't take a lot of write-downs to destroy the whole bank. That's what happened. It's not the mark-to-market that's the problem. It's the leverage that's the problem.
Right. No, I agree. I agree with you. I think that the point is that mark-to-market actually is something that we have to have something to how to value things and how to put things correctly together. But the fact is that if we didn't have the let me restate this, if we didn't have the mark to market, maybe some of these banks that had the leverage wouldn't have a problem. Hang on. But the fact of the matter is, because we have the mark to market, that should have regulated the amount of money that they put out there.
Should have is the right word.
Right.
But what did Citigroup do? Citigroup went and hid. Because they wanted the same leverage. They wanted to play with the big boys like Goldman and Lehman and Bear Stearns. Pandit and who's the guy before? Chuck Prince were complaining. You know, these guys have an advantage on us. They can use leverage that we can't. So what did Citigroup do? They simulated it. They went out and they put $1 trillion in SIVs that they were authorized to hold these off the balance sheet, and the way they get around this rule of not having them on the balance sheet is if they held less than 50% of a side endeavor that they were in, they didn't have to put it on the balance sheet. So Citigroup and all these banks went out there and they bought 49% control of all kinds of other risky assets. They hid them in SIVs. And then this is how they manipulated earnings as well. As long as this stuff was going up in price, which it had been until about a year and a half ago, they could bring some of this stuff back on the books. They needed an extra penny. They bring stuff back from the SIV onto the balance sheet. All these financial wizardry games are what is causing the problem.
Mm-hmm.
But now, when asset prices are tumbling across the board, Citigroup doesn't. You know, they want to keep be able to hide them. They don't want these things brought back onto their balance sheet under any circumstances. And, you know, they did a report a few weeks ago, a town hall meeting, Citigroup called it. And I looked at it and I laughed my head off. You know, this is a joke. You know, they were not marking those assets to market. And the market immediately plunged after this town hall. Citigroup immediately plunged after this town hall. And they didn't believe it. I don't believe it. And guess what? The Fed is back giving more money to Citigroup, and now more money to Bank of America because Merrill Lynch was not marked to market,
yep.
And Bank of America took over Merrill Lynch.
So now with all the money that's being spent by the Fed, by the Treasury, you know, we just got that additional second tranche of the TARP. I've renamed it, by the way. I'm calling it a trap. I changed the letter.
That's a good word.
I changed the letters a little bit. We're calling it a trap, in which it seems to be a trap for the taxpayer. But Recently we had, I think you know Peter Schiff, or you know of him, we had Peter Schiff on the show, and he was talking about how, you know, this hysteria about how the dollar is going to be systematically obliterated in valuation, and how it's going to zero, and how, you know, we have this this process where we shouldn't be in the U.S., and we have his philosophy was to move out of the U.S. into Asian in particular, and some of the other regions with money. But I wonder, in terms of the dollar, this is something that's been bothering me. In terms of the dollar, how is it that we have the dollar moving in a direction down? And of course, it's a comparative tool. I mean, is Schiff right that we're going to see this kind of movement against the dollar, and then it just goes to zero, or essentially down to almost nothing?
Do you mean the dollar moving up? Because the dollar has actually generally been strengthening over the last.
He's been talking about it going down.
Schiff is, yes, yeah. And I think he's clearly wrong. He's ignoring a whole bunch of things. There's a capital flight right now out of China. I mean, let's talk about Schiff's thesis here. Schiff's thesis is the U.S. is printing all this money, that it's going to be hyperinflation here in the United States. The U.S. dollar is going to zero, and that one should buy stocks overseas. That is his thesis. I think I said this, the U.S. dollar was going to zero, or you said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What happened is he recommended investments overseas, and those investments actually fell more than investments in the United States. And not only that, but the dollar strengthened. The mm-hmm. dollar's been strengthening lately. It's right now it's actually falling in some kind of a trading range. But every time the dollar falls, Schiff comes on and says, oh my God, it's down 3% today, it's going to be 5% tomorrow, it's going to be 10% next week, it's going to be 20%. And then what are you going to do? Well, I'm sorry, that's not going to happen. For a lot of reasons. Yes, the U.S. is printing, but so is every country in the world.
Right.
China is printing like mad. On a percentage basis, China is probably printing as much, if not more, than the United States. Plus, we've got a capital flight out of China. Russia has absolutely collapsed because oil prices have fallen. And Peter Schiff likes the euro. But the fact of the matter is, European banks lent to Latin America, and they lent to the Baltic states. Problems U.S. banks at least avoided this go-around is there are additional problems that the European banks have, and we saw the European banks also get involved in the Iceland situation. So there are a number of problems in Europe that Peter Schiff simply is either ignoring or is not aware of. But either way,
Why would he be so radical? I mean, I'm not understanding there seems to be some very basic tenets of his discussion that are, are at least, more radical than anything. Is it for marketing?
I believe it is for marketing. And actually, I'm going to talk about that in a post sometime probably next week. But we're going to look at the calls that he has made, and just take a look. But the one thing that's kind of irritated me the most, I mean, he's entitled to his opinions. He is,
yep.
And he also sounds very charismatic. And it's also important to point out that he is absolutely right about one thing. Mm. He is right that the policies of the U.S. government are fatally flawed.
Yeah.
He's correct on that.
Yeah.
So when he comes out and he's correct on this, and people look at, he's correct on this, well, he's correct on everything. No, he's correct that the U.S. policy decisions are horrid. Because they are. But he's ignoring that China, that Japan, that Europe, that the UK, Canada, Australia, literally every place else is doing the same thing.
Right.
And if they're all doing it to the same relative degree, the U.S. dollar is not going to fall. U.S. interest rates are already at zero. They're not going any lower. That's it. They're not going any lower.
Mm.
But when the bank of there's still some room left for the Bank of England to lower, and there's still some room left for Trichet to lower. And Trichet and the Bank of England, the ECB and the Bank of England are going to lower. That's going to pressure those currencies relative to the dollar. And with the price of oil collapsing, and it may continue to collapse, the balance of trade deficit in the United States is actually improving. And there's real problems right now in the Mideast because they've squandered much of the money when oil prices were higher, that those countries are actually starting to run trade deficits right now. So there's this whole global picture that one needs to look at. Instead, Schiff has his eyes solely focused on the problems in the United States, saying, well, U.S. has these problems, so you should invest elsewhere. He fails to look at the problems elsewhere and come to the conclusion, you know what, maybe we ought not be in equities anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting point, because if you think about this idea, that I think that it's interesting when if the U.S. dollar, again, you have to look at it in relative terms, but if the U.S. dollar is to fall to nothing, if there was such a thing able to be, you know, to happen, the truth is that the rest of the world would be in big trouble. You know, we have trade partners, we have cross-currency trading that goes on, we have requirements of funding our liabilities and debt with maybe money from China, et cetera. Well, that's just not going to happen if the dollar goes to zero, right? And everybody else gets hurt. It's simply like, you know, if I say that I don't like my arm, I'm not going to cut it off just because I don't like it, because it's going to hurt me if I do so. I have to do something about it. So simply, the idea, I think, is a little bit backwards. It makes for a good discussion, but it's a little bit backwards. I mean, I just think that, you know, if you're going to say that such a radical statement, I agree with you. That's a good point. That you know, why would you want to be in stocks if there's so many problems on a global basis with debt, with currencies, with a slowdown, with the pricing? It just doesn't make any sense.
Right. Exactly. The Schiff believes that the tail wags the dog. That's how I look at it. He believes that this decoupling can happen here, that the U.S. can cut off an arm and a leg, and that nothing's going to happen to China if it does. But already, you know, we're seeing some things in China on a massive scale. Hundreds of millions of jobs, millions from one city. People are migrating back from manufacturing districts back to the farm in China. The anything under 8% is almost a hard landing for China, and you know their GDP is probably going to rise 5%. That's if you believe it. I actually think it's probably contracting. I don't believe, you know, people, you know, we got all the shadow stats and the numbers here in the United States, you know, talking about, you know, how the figures here in the United States are bad. Well, what about the numbers coming out from China? Do you believe those GDP growth numbers over there? I don't. Mm. I don't believe ours, but I don't believe theirs either.
Right.
So China is in a very bad state here if they need 8% GDP and to keep moving the workers to the cities. They're not going to get it. They're not going to get it without falling demand from U.S. consumers and European consumers. It's not going to happen. And we're seeing it right now. Did you see the reports on the Baltic shipping rates headed towards zero? You know, there's immense overcapacity in shipping right now. The shipping rates have plunged amazing amount.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
zero.
If you look at the chart of the Baltic shipping rates, it went from 8,000 down to absolutely nothing, which is just unbelievable. What about this contango trade or this contango idea, where you're having many of these companies now starting to bulk up on the oil and put it into into their you know, tankers offshore and save it for a later date? What do you think about that?
Well, it's a guaranteed trade if you can find a ship, you know, willing to just, you know, sit out there and just sit on it. It's a guaranteed trade. So you know, you have some of the brokerage houses, you know, looking into doing that. They can secure a ship. They're holding it. And what we're talking about here is contango in crude. That's the front month price on the futures contract being $8 or $9 or more a month lower currently than in the future.
Mm-hmm.
So one can buy the oil right now and sell it later at a certain guaranteed price, hold that oil in the meantime, and as long as the storage costs are less than the differential between prices, there's a guaranteed profit. So, but what that means actually is that demand front end is absolutely collapsing. Now, what I think is mistaken. It seems like the marketeer is not very efficient. I think at times it's certainly not. And but I don't think that demand is coming back. I think that companies buying oil at futures prices because it looks attractive, I think it just looks attractive relative to where it was. I think when we actually get to a year from now, I don't think those prices are going to be back up there. Yeah. So, but we'll see. That's my prediction. But as long as they're willing to pay those prices now to lock them in, then this contango situation continues,
right.
And then there's this guaranteed profit out there. But the front month demand is not there. So, and inventory levels in the United States are at record high levels here, so that's just a case of falling demand. Yeah. I think oil prices, all in all, are going to be pressured because of this amount of oil that's now in storage that's going to be coming on the market on top of what the oil producers are going to be producing.
Right.
So we're going to have to see OPEC probably cut back production even more.
Right.
And, you know, what a rapid reversal from all the peak oilers who said oil was going to go to $300 a barrel. Well, we're probably going to see $30 a barrel pretty soon. Mm.
So what do you think about this Bank of America / Citibank, or not even a slash, I'll say or Citibank fiasco? I mean, do you think that there's going to be some kind of need to further bail them out or do a Wachovia kind of deal or a Washington Mutual? What's going to happen here?
Well, they've already agreed to further, and it's the guarantees that really annoy me. I said at the time when Bank of America agreed to merge with Merrill Lynch that it made no sense.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't make any sense. Merrill Lynch was trading at roughly $18 a share and was collapsing. If Bank of America didn't agree to step in and buy them, Merrill Lynch would have collapsed to like nothing probably within a few weeks. Instead, they agreed to buy them at $44 a share when it was trading at 18 and collapsing. They could have picked it up for $5 a share probably.
Yep.
Or maybe less. Bear Stearns at $3 a share. So it didn't make any sense. And I'm still trying to figure out whether this was sheer incompetence on the part of Bank of America, or if the Fed kind of at bazooka point said, you know what, you just volunteered to rescue Merrill Lynch, now go make it happen. So what's happened in the meantime, though, is we're finding, surprise, surprise, that the assets of Merrill Lynch weren't properly marked to market. They're not worth what they said they were. So the Fed's going to inject still more capital. Was the amount $15 billion, I think? And more importantly,
but $100 billion backup.
They're going to, more importantly, they're going to guarantee the assets of Merrill. That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
For the government to come in and guarantee the assets of a private entity.
Everything is guaranteed, and it's causing more of a moral risk than I've ever seen in my life. And it's amazing. Once again, I'll tell you what it did. It gave false hope during the late November, early December time period, or mid to late December time period, for people to go back into stocks, only to get their portfolios cut out from under them once again, and because they believed that everything was just fine, the economy is fine, because we're seeing information flow that's bogus, the jobs numbers that were bogus for so long, the BLS and their kind of shenanigans that go on there, or their lack of information and trying to pawn it off as actual numbers and timely numbers. And on top of that, you have, you know, it seems that somebody wrote about recently, you know, why doesn't the market, the government step in when the market does too good? You know, all of a sudden it takes a parabolic move up and stop it from moving up. I mean, the fact of the matter is that it was a great ride there, but then the back end, the hangover was very difficult. And, you know, we didn't participate in a lot of that upside, to be honest with you, but we didn't get any of the downside. As a matter of fact, you know, the S&P 500 is down, what, 6% year to date, give or take a percent or so. You know, we're up this year. And I think, what do you do? What is Sitka Pacific? What did you do last year? You had, I know last time we talked, you were kind of coming into a decent end of the year, but where did you actually end up?
We ended up actually quite well. Our hedge growth strategy, which is a long short strategy, finished the year plus 13.7%. And it was remarkably smooth the entire year. No significant drawdowns the entire way. Absolute return strategy is where our IRA clients are. We can't short in that, but we can and did hedge at times, but probably not enough in inverse index ETFs. So it had a little bit more of a ride, but we ended up the year almost 7%, plus 6.9%. So our two key strategies, where well over 90% of our clients are, is plus 13.7 and plus 6.9. And so I think those are pretty good numbers. Right now, absolute return is, I think, up about a percent this year, mm-hmm. which is doing pretty good.
Yeah.
And hedge growth, I believe, is close to flat, maybe down a half a percent or something.
Right.
So
it's been a very rough ride.
A good start in 2009.
Yeah, but the problem is, and let me just say something. The problem is, we've done an awful lot of trading. I don't know how much trading you guys do at your funds, but you know, what's interesting is that a lot of the times that we've had to make these gigantic and complete left turns on the market midday, let's say, for example. We went, I think you and I talked about this, and I was kind of ranting to you on the phone one day, and I was saying, this is crap, this mar, you know how I get. And and I was talking to you, it was right before Obama talked, and we put in a major short right then. When he went on that day, I said, you know what, I've seen this movie before. You know, there's a lot of anticipation, a lot of excitement, and what could he possibly say that's going to really rally the troops and make everything all better and all exciting? So what we did was we went and we actually shorted the, you know, the markets in a hedged way, I should say, you know, through a couple of different mechanisms. And, you know, that saved a tremendous amount of potential pain that could have had. We didn't have that much exposure to begin with. I think we told you we went into the year with a 3% position because we were really nervous about some of the markets. And we are actually up 1%, a little over 1% for the year to date also. But that only comes when you're not just I think sitting there waiting for things to happen. I got in a big argument last week with someone about a buy and hold strategy, the quote unquote lazy portfolio strategy. You've heard of this?
No, I've not heard of it. But what's the lazy portfolio strategy down in 2008? There's no way it's up.
Let me tell you something. They will argue, and how dare you say something like that? Because they were 10% ahead of the S&P.
Wow, so they were 10% ahead of the S&P.
Yep.
So let me see. They fell 28.9% last 28.5% last
wait,
year, and they're bragging about.
Yes, because they beat the S&P.
I think we need to look at real returns, not beating some mythical index. I mean, who was it? Legg Mason, Bill Miller, that bragged about beating the index, and it was just really by just, you know, 1 or 2 points for a year. What did he do last year? Down 65%. So, okay, so you beat by a percent, you beat by a percent, you beat by a percent, and then you're down 65%. Well, guess what? You gave it all back, and then some, picking up pennies in front of a steamroller.
It's laughable. It's not even something to talk about, because now they're talking to me, oh, you can't beat this, you can't beat that, and I don't even want to talk about it. The fact of the matter is that, you know, by just sitting there waiting for the truck to bowl you over is just ridiculous. But so what do you see what do you see the outlook? I mean, obviously short term volatility, clearly you know, the downturn after the beginning of the year was clearly a my opinion, a result of the cleanup from you know, after end of year tax settling and window dressing, et cetera. The continuation of this crazy market that any day could just vault in any direction. We have the continuation of the nonsense that goes on by option expiration. We know why that is. Once you get to the round numbers, it gets a little bit hairy. But what do you think is in store for us aside from just being down? I mean, do we see anything that's changing?
Oh, I think there's some things changing. First off, we're in high cash position here at Sitka. And in both of our key strategies right now, we're hedged. So I'm comfortable with how we're positioned. Absolute return is we got positioned in golds in the miners, and we're hedged with the negative inverse funds on the Russell, the S&P, and the NASDAQ. I'm comfortable with that, especially sitting in high cash position here now. So, we can react at a later date if you talk to. Hedge growth is actually neither of our strategies is really that active. Hedge growth, we rebalance that thing. It's a long short strategy, and we rebalance it about once a month. Now, if there's a shift, if we decide to go from net long back to market neutral, we can do that at any time. And if we're short something, like say we were Fannie Mae, the day Fannie Mae dropped from $8 to 89 cents. We're not going to hold a stock short at 89 cents anymore. So we're going to ring the register. But basically, we don't trade. We try and trade these strategies once a month. But if a situation arrives, like, Fannie Mae, well, we're going to cash out. Mainly, if we're going to reverse, and this is what you talked about, you have to be flexible enough to reverse. We came into our absolute return strategy, came into the year, we were 60% long, 40% cash, and no hedges. I was actually quite nervous about that. We reversed on a dime. My partner picked it up. When the S&P tagged 930, the Russell hit a retrace line. Everything was in these rising wedge patterns, which is extremely bearish. Sentiment, we still believe this is a bear market, and our sentiment readings reached extreme levels of we're going off to the moon again. And, it was maybe just lucky that we got this out to the day, but, you have to be willing to change your mind in this market. And that's one thing that you do. That's one thing that we do at Sitka. And I know, some others do the same thing. I've got, friends that are managing money that do the same thing. But it's one thing that Peter Schiff does not do. I mean, he's got a strategy that is the same buy and hold. It's just not buy and hold in the U.S. It's buy and hold in outside of the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same thing of sell and hold on the U.S. dollar I guess would describe his thesis. And I think one needs more flexibility than that.
Well, you know,
the U.S. dollar is likely to go into a trading range, and stocks are likely to drift down. If the U.S. drifts down, we're going to see equities drift down worldwide. We're not in a hyperinflationary environment at all. We're in a deflationary environment.
Right.
So Peter Schiff is right about one thing, about the U.S. policy decisions being wrong, but he's been literally wrong about everything else.
Well, I think also the other thing that I'll mention to you is that I believe that one of the biggest downfalls of investors, professional investors, that is, over the last however long it's been, has been the pound on the table, absolute feeling that their strategy is the only one that works, whether it's value growth, small cap, large cap, blended, quant styled, or fundamental, whatever it is. I think that once you get caught up in believing your own, drinking your own Kool-Aid, kind of, going along with that, everything that you do because maybe a few years was the right thing to do, you end up very hurt one day, because we all know that strategy styles, times change and they cycle. Values in, gross in, large caps in, small caps in, mid caps in, and whether you want to believe it or not, I think the problem that we have, generally speaking, is once you get so absolute, flexibility and being, very much able to step back and see what's going on in the environment, where is it that makes sense, is the name of the game. I think otherwise you're just going to get, you can get just, you may do well for a while, You know, even a broken clock is right twice a day, right? But mm-hmm. but at the same time, you cannot be right forever.
Oh, that's right. You can't be right forever you can't be right forever in any circumstances. You're always going to make mistakes. The question is how quick are you to adapt those to change to those mistakes and not stay in a certain attitude. We're looking for the S&P. I have got a personal target, the S&P for 600. But guess what? You know what? We might not get there. We might overshoot.
And we might overshoot to the downside.
Overshoot to the downside, sure. why can't we fall to 450?
We could.
400. Why can't we?
Right, well, because people will be screaming in the streets, running around naked, freaking out is why.
Well, that's not a good reason. But, yeah, they might be if that happens. But we can certainly get down there. There's nothing that says we can't. And there's nothing that says that the market becomes infatuated with Obama and the S&P shoots up 300 points starting tomorrow. One is going to have to adapt to either of those two things. And they're both possible. Although, you know, we're aligned right now with the idea that we're in a wave five down here in Elliott wave terms and that we see lower lows coming. But, you know, guess what? If the market starts acting better, then we have to change our minds.
Yep.
And that's what it amounts to. And that's what's wrong with the buy and hold people. Look, I mean, you know, so they buy their index. And they bought it, let's say they bought the S&P 10 years ago. Where are they now? Are they flat? No gains for 10 years. You know, they could have bought, you know, treasuries, actually, and made a killing over that same 10-year period.
Yep. No, I know. I mean, there's something that has to be done with that because I think it's really hurt people, and I'm not necessarily pointing a finger at anybody that's listening, and I'm not saying that you shouldn't do this or what you're doing is bad. That's not the case. I think that what has been taught to us, all of us, about the idea of just buying and holding on something forever. And I use this analogy, I say all the time, you know, GE is a stock that's bought and historically was never a stock that was sold. People that bought GE would never sell GE. GE is in the toilet. And if you never sold GE, you're probably losing money unless you were given it to, you know, by Grant and Sally, you know, 25, 30 years ago. But, you know, I just think that the flexibility, I think that's the whole point here in the summary of this discussion is, you know, flexibility is key and we need to make sure that we stay armed, understanding that times are changing very quickly. Obama's plan has been changing quickly. It's been changing almost, you know, daily and between 3 million, 2.5 million, now 4 million jobs that he's saving, changing it to a tax rebate and tax benefits rather than just a total shovel-ready type of process. I mean, this is, you know, the we have to be aware of that and I think that... you know, not the shame is not being able to be flexible. The shame is not being able to be able to see that there are changing dynamics that happen, and that's where everybody gets hurt the most.
Yeah, what I would like people to do that are listening in is to go pull up a chart of the Nikkei, the Japanese index. Pull up a chart of it and take a look at it. I'm not saying that the U.S. is going to exactly follow that, but what I am suggesting is that the U.S. might follow that. And stock prices in Japan fell for 20 years, and it can happen here. We can, and if even if you say, "Well, my God, that can never happen here," well, people tell me the same about deflation. Mish, deflation can never happen. Well, it did happen. We're in it. But let's assume that you don't buy U.S. stocks prices can go down for 18 years. Well, maybe they just go sideways for 18 years. Maybe. Why not? Why can't they?
Anything's possible.
And if they do, what does that do, Andrew, to all the pension plan assumptions that are out there that have made these assumptions that the stock market's going to rise for annualized 8.5% a year? What's that going to do to all the insurance companies that have made these annuities that have promised investors returns of 6 or 7%? These boomers are now retiring, and the stock market's cut in half, and then goes sideways for another 10 years. we're going to have a lot of pain at insurance companies, I can guarantee you.
It's not a pretty picture. One of these days we'll talk about also how the insurance companies just changed their rules and changed their CSO tables, the assumption of death for life insurance companies. Basically, they went from a CSO 58 a number of years ago to a CSO 80 to a CSO 2000, where two things are happening. Number one, people are living longer, so they can try to assume that insurance is cheaper. And number two, they can value the required amount of money they have, the corridor, if you will, or the amount of money that they have to have in reserves, based on now dying at 120 years old. Wow. No kidding. Why do you think that Hartford last week, or not last week, a couple of months ago, was going down, 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 down? All of a sudden, one day, they popped up out of nowhere. Two reasons. They said they're going to make better earnings, which I don't believe. That's the new game in by the way, that's the new game in town. You know, HP comes out with great earnings. And I'm like, wait a second, how'd they do that, right? Well, I realized something. They can't lose. If they don't make their earnings in 3 months from now, they blame it on the economy. Things changed. We saw what we were going into at that time changed dramatically, and no one will fault them. No kidding. And if they do make their earnings, or they make somewhere even close to it, okay, well, you know, that's what we thought. They can't lose. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, all these games are being played. And
that's the thing. We're going to put that song on. Games people play. Yeah, I like that. Games people play.
The games people play every night and every day, every day and every night. Yeah, exactly. That's what's going on, and it's with level three assets, and it's with mark-to-market stuff, and the Fed and the SEC are turning a blind eye. And here we got, you know, all the SEC stuff with Madoff. Yeah, the SEC's been essentially useless. And in fact, the SEC's been...
Yeah, let's talk. He's not talking about having sex with Madoff. You're not talking about sex.
Sex is not useless. The SEC is. The SEC was who sponsored the rating agencies. Before the SEC sponsorship of them, rating agencies made their money by how good they issued ratings. The SEC came along and said, oh, you know what? The debt of every company needs to be rated. So we need to hire, we need to have independent rated. Independent? They christened Moody's, S&P, and Fitch, said, ding, you are our big three rating agencies. You rate all the debt coming out. So Moody's, Fitch, and the S&P, guess what? They got paid not on how good they rated the debt. They got paid based on the quantity of the debt that they rated.
Yeah, no, it's ridiculous.
So guess what happened to how well they rated debt? We know, because we saw AAA rated.
They were the whores. They were the whores of the bond industry. The whores of the bond industry. That's the bottom line.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's pretty pathetic. You know, whores of the rating service. I mean, it's just terrible. But we can go on forever. You and I, we do oftentimes. Thank you for joining us today. We're going to end it today. And I encourage everybody, you want to check out what he's writing, because he's writing some great things. Go over to, just type in Mish in Google. You'll find that. Of course, you could go to and learn more about Sitka Pacific, which is a great money management firm. And I think that they'll probably provide you some good information where you can take a look at what they're doing and how they're doing it. And I want to thank you, as always, for enlightening us in terms of the, let's just say, the BS that goes on in the world. And, of course, all the sex that's going on with Madoff.
Exactly. It's a pleasure to be on the show, Andrew.
Appreciate
I look forward
it.
To being back on in a few weeks.
All right, great. Thanks so much, Mitch. I'm going to wrap it up right there. There's a lot of time that we spent today talking about some of the negative. I'm hoping we've been stood up a couple of times, of course, by Nouriel Roubini, Mr. Roubini, Professor Roubini, Dr. Roubini. You stood us up three times now, and that is not making me for a happy fellow. But by the time we get to you, maybe this whole mess will be over, and you're going to, what else are you going to have to talk about? I don't know. But we also have, hopefully coming very shortly, the CEO, Mr. Safer from ProShares. We have a couple of questions on the 3 to 4 o'clock hour, which we've gotten to the bottom of, I think, and we're going to be talking about that with him. He's supposed to be coming up very shortly. Lots of great guests coming. Again, if you want to meet me in Orlando at the Money Show, please drop us a line. Go to the website, thedisciplinedinvestor.com, for more information. And we're going to wrap it up right here. Thanks for listening to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.